Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3377 establishes an income tax credit for married parents who elect to stay home to care for children under 13 years of age. The maximum credit allowed is the lesser of 5% of the average wages earned by the non-working spouse during the prior 5 years, up to $2,000. The credit is means-tested. It's reduced for taxpayers with adjusted gross income above $40,000 and not available at all for taxpayers above $42,000. And it would become available beginning the 2002 tax year.
Representative Minnis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Karen Minnis, state representative in House 20. In today's economy, some families have difficult choices to make in raising a family and financially supporting themselves. A, because of financial constraints, sometimes require both spouses to work despite the recent arrival of a child. Some would prefer to make the sacrifice in income and stay at home with their families. And some parents are near the threshold of a government subsidy, but would rather not have to go there. They'd like to be able to be independent. Parents aren't even offered the choice to remain at home to spend time with and care for their children. This is especially evident in low-income families. House Bill 3377 attempts to address some of these issues. It will help parents who want to have one spouse stay at home to raise their young children rather than both parents working and having the kids in daycare all day long. It's a way to help families deal with short-term financial sacrifices they're making. We need to provide opportunities for families to succeed, not place barriers before their stability and happiness. Families that need child care can receive a child care tax credit, but families who decide to have one parent stay at home to care for their children get no tax credit. The timing on discussing this bill is especially poignant given the fact that Monday was tax filing day. It helps families make sacrifices when one spouse stops working to stay home and take care of their children. I do realize that not all families are able to do that. This is a good bill that helps Oregon's working family while being fiscally responsible. I urge you to pass House Bill 3377 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Representative Minnis? Anybody? Bring in Representative Schrader, and then we can hit them both.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Kurt Schrader, House District 23. I'm testifying in support of our Majority Leader's House Bill. I also introduced a similar House bill, House Bill 2461, to accomplish much the same thing. This idea's time has actually come. I mean, we introduced this last session. Representative Loken and I worked on this concept, tried to rough out the thoughts. I think we got a ways down the process, and people are starting to understand that it's time for us to put our money where our mouth is. We talk about family values. We want people to stay home, raise their children, but we don't give them the wherewithal to do that. It seems strange to me that we currently have tax credits for families that leave their children with complete strangers, and yet we do not provide any opportunity or financial incentive for people who would like to stay home and impart the values that we think are important in society today themselves. It's time for us, I think, to step up to the plate. This is an idea that I think Representative Minnis and I came to somewhat independently, but it's obviously just a logical thing to do. My original bill came from a fence-line conversation with a constituent of mine up in Estacada, where she had given up her job to stay home and work with the children, and I think that's appropriate. And they're paying significant loss of income to do that. So why can't we help them by giving a bit of a tax credit to that remaining spouse's taxable income so that they can get by? Representative Minnis has targeted her tax credit to those that really need it. These are truly the working poor, if you will. People are having a tough time making ends meet. This is not a rich person's tax credit. This is a good targeted credit. If we want to keep children out of our corrections system, if we want to keep them out of the court system, the mental health system, you name it, this is one vehicle to help complement our existing tax credits program that we have now for our childcare. So I'd urge the committee to look at this very closely. Again, it's an idea whose time has come, I think, and urge your support, House Bill 3377.
Questions for either Representative Miss or Representative Schrader? Yeah, Representative Beck.
Question. So this would benefit private employers. Public, how would this...
What?
Who gets the tax rate, the employer or personal income? Right?
It's personal income. Basically, what it does is it's a credit against the remaining worker in the family that's bringing home the bacon, so to speak. There'd be a tax credit against his taxable income.
Ms. Bile, let's hear from you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Linda Bile. I'm a full-time working mom. I have a full-time working husband. I have two children, one's 9 and one's 12. I've always worked, and I enjoy working. But today I'm here to support House Bill number 3377. And that's because working or enjoying working isn't really the issue here today. The issue is one of priorities. House Bill 3377, I've looked it over, and, you know, interestingly enough, the biggest benefit that I see is hope. Hope for the two-income family to go ahead and try to make it on one income. For myself, we are not what we would consider poor, but we're on the cusp. We're those people who don't make enough money to live on one income, but yet can't afford, you know, to have the other person not working. I mean, it's we're right in between. We don't qualify for any programs. We don't have any of those benefits. We're just working and paying our taxes. So it's not only just a financial thing, though. As far as I looked, when I looked it over, I thought, well, you know, in terms of our budget, we could probably, you know, really use a benefit like this so that we could go ahead and try to make a go of it. And, of course, the financial support or the financial loss is significant, you know. But you take a look at your everyday budget and you say, okay, where can I cut? And how can I make this work? And this looks like something that would really be helpful. It would really help things work. So, anyway, if there's any questions, I would be happy to answer them for you.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is probably more appropriate to either of the representatives. Did you consider indexing this for inflation? Because, you know, often you'll pass a bill like this, and 10 years down the road, its significance has dwindled away because of inflation.
No, we did not consider that, but I would certainly be open to working with the committee.
I think that would make sense because it will protect the value of this for families as time goes by.
And as I understand it, the credit is this 5% figure without regard to the number of children. This isn't a per-child credit. This
That's
is
correct.
Is the same if it's one or five children, so we're not tying this to the expense necessarily of the children. But okay.
That's correct.
Deborah, you're not signed up. I have any other questions? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Carlson.
I just have one question. I'm a working mom and also have three children, and two of them are still at home. And I just wanted to clarify when in the bill it says that a spouse is non-working, that women who are at home work as well. Would you agree with that?
We better change that to non-employed outside the home.
Right.
Very non-PC here.
Thank you. It is work.
Question. Anybody else? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Deborah, I do have a question.
Mm-hmm. 3 days only.
It's more an administrative or compliance question, I guess. When you have criteria such as a spouse making a voluntary decision to leave the workforce, I guess that's probably the one that raises the most subjective criteria or qualification for this. How does the department look at that kind of a qualification?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Actually, Mr. Chair, that was one of the concerns that we had with the bill. I did notice that it was also scheduled for a public hearing and work session next week, so
I had intended to make comments at that time.
Okay.
But we would suggest that voluntary actually be removed so that we don't have that debate.
So basically, it would be the spouse leave the workforce so that they're... Yeah, okay.
So a person who is laid off, for example, and she would stay at home rather than looking for employment, we would not have to argue with them about whether or not that's voluntary.
Yeah. Any sense to anybody, Representative Carlson?
Mr. Chair, the other question I would have is, does this apply to a person who doesn't choose to work in the first place?
Well, you have to have the five-year employment.
Okay.
History.
So you have to actually have been working for 5 years. Mm-hmm. I think that when I was looking at it.
And in fact, the credit is tied to that average wage, isn't it? I think the average...
Okay.
Wage and salary income. Again, Deborah, technically, does that work for a self-employed person?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that that would. I believe that the wage and salary would only refer to an employee and not to a self-employed person, so that may be something that needs to be addressed as well.
How would you... I'm thinking of somebody who maybe is, an attorney, partner in a firm that wants to take off time to raise the children, of course, with the $40,000 annual income limit. Well, it takes care of that, I guess, huh? Must have been working for legal aid. No, but I guess then they're employees. I don't know, but yeah, that raises a question, I guess, that we're treating self-employed differently than we would be treating salaried employees.
You're correct, Mr. Chair, because I believe under federal law that is not wage and salary income. That is self-employment income, and they would not qualify. And the income limit actually is... simply that in no case can it exceed $40,000.
Well, that's true.
Someone who has
wages
of $200,000 would be able to base it on that $40,000 maximum amount.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm. You're right. Representative Bates, let's go to him first.
I apologize for not having a chance to read this carefully last night. The point that brought up by Representative Carlson about the non-working spouse must have a history of 5 or more years immediately preceding the departure from the workforce is quite concerning to me. That seems discriminatory. There are many young women, they're 18, 19, 20 years old, who are married, who would like to stay home with their children. Would this exclude them from the tax credit? Am I reading this correctly? I mean, they would not have had an opportunity to be 5 years in the workforce. And that's one of the most common ages that women become pregnant is 20, 21, 22, and they would not have that five-year period of time in the workforce. If the goal of this, the policy of this, is to allow men or women who are young and have children, to have a better chance of staying home and raising those children.
Well, see, that's too young to have kids anyway, so this encourages them.
This is the Republican answer to birth control.
The Republican answer to birth control.
Let's see.
No, we just say no.
Somehow, Max, I don't believe that happens.
Representative Witt, I'm sorry, Representative Bates, were you done?
I'm just concerned about that, and I wish I'd brought up in the representatives were here, and I should have.
All right, we can ask them back. Just bring this up again. Representative Witt.
Yeah, on the same point, Mr. Chairman, the way I read it, the average annual wage and salary for the 5 years immediately preceding, if they weren't working for three of those years, zeros would go into those columns, and then you would take the total for the 5 years and divide by five, and I think that probably also is discriminatory and not necessarily good policy, so I think we need to try to find some other creative way to address that.
Well, yeah, I guess I do want to look back on line 13, that we do have the non-working spouse must have a work history of five or more years immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it does say that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd have the same concern Representative Bates has on that.
Of course, the more liberal you make it, then the higher the fiscal impact, the revenue impact. Ed, do you know, and you prepared the revenue impact, and of course it's kind of a crystal ball thing because you got no idea, but if we were to, even looking at expanding this to include self-employment income, would that change your revenue impact, or is that kind of all in the mix of what you've already contemplated, do you think?
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, I think each of the issues we've looked at would probably affect the participation rate, which is what I try to estimate.
Mm-hmm.
So every condition that we relax makes it more available to, potentially available anyway, to more taxpayers. Probably increases the revenue impact.
Any other questions? You may have to work with the representatives between now and next week. I'll mention that I asked Mr. Chamov here as he was walking by, and this interesting turn of events on this, but I asked him if this raised some implications under the Tanner case, and he thinks it may. I want to get a legal opinion from Legislative Council on that as mm-hmm. well. Trying just to, have you looked at that at all?
Mr. Chair, yes.
See, I'm stealing all your thunder, aren't I?
No, that's just fine. We had the same concerns as to whether or not this would need to be available under that decision.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that it probably would be.
Okay, I'll ask Mr. Chamoff for an opinion on that, too. Okay, anything else? Thank you. Then we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3377. And let me see, I got a note from Representative Nelson, who asked us to schedule 3887 today. She says it's not ready, so we will not be going to House Bill 3887. Let me go to a work session on House Bill 3942 and open that. I want to, first of all, well, Paul, do you want to come on up and kind of set the stage for this? Thank you, Ed.
Mr. Chair, on House Bill 3942, we have, you have gotten a lot of feedback from particularly the business community regarding the business activity tax, which is something that I think a lot of people are not familiar with. And what we've been doing is compiling a list of issues that have been raised, and that issue now, that list that you should have with your materials for today. I added one more thing from the list we had Monday, and that was estimates of the base. But the issues that have been talked about, and these have been raised in a number of different settings, but they're listed really, I think, somewhat in terms of importance, but especially the exporters. We've had that consistent concern of people, businesses that export to other states, concerned about how the business activity tax may affect their competitive position. A pass-through income has been a consistent issue. How would this relate to the personal income tax? And the apportionment issues, both in terms of the base and in terms of capital expenditures. So those four, I think, have come up pretty consistently in the discussions.
And go ahead through the others.
The other issues, the implementation date, we've heard from Department of Revenue that they think at least 18 months and even longer would be preferable for them, not only in terms of their preparation, but also preparing taxpayers, educating them in terms of what differences there would be in the system. We heard testimony from regulated industries, particularly the insurance industry, was concerned about how this, their freedom in terms of pricing decisions and how this would affect them when they don't have that flexibility on adjusting their prices. Nonprofits are actually included in the base when they're not currently included in a profits-based income tax, such as we have now. So there's concern there of being brought into the tax base. Filing threshold issues for small business. We've worked with $100,000 gross receipts, but of course that's a number that could be adjusted. Zero bracket amount is another number that could help small filers by allowing them a certain proportion of that income that would be non-taxable. How would it fit with existing credits in the system, like pollution control credit, for example? And how that would be administered by the Department of Revenue. Other implementation issues in general, I've listed there separately, along with the implementation date. Another concern we've had is from startups, because this is something that has come up, I think, a number of times in reviewing our tax system, is that Oregon's probably a good place to start a business, not a particularly good place once you're successful. And what you'd rather do is start a business in Oregon and then move to Washington, because Washington's system is the reverse.
But startups would be paying taxes based on business activity rather than net income. So if they don't have any net income, of course, you're not paying income taxes under the current system. The other issues is the estimates of the base. As we've spent a lot of time on this and gotten a lot of feedback, I've become more and more convinced that I think we're underestimating the size of the base as the bill was written. We've asked the department to help us in terms of determining that base, and really what they've done is done a good job of giving us what's clearly identifiable. And so this is the numbers we've got are very hard, very tangible, but I think they're conservative. I think the base out there is probably bigger than this, and this is something in the interim to get a better sense of what is the ultimate size of that base. Of course, what that means is you could have a lower rate and generate the same amount of money. So, I mean, that is a significant issue. And then the other issue that Mr. Chair, you want to talk about is interim activities regarding the package itself.
Okay. We have three people here who were down on Tuesday to testify on this, and we were not able to get to the bill, so I want to bring them up to testify. Any discussion among committee members before we hear from them? And let's bring up Bob Russell, Jennifer Bowe, and Jeff. Yes. I apologize for not getting to you on Tuesday. Hope you enjoyed listening to whatever it is we were talking about.
Not a problem. We're happy to come back today.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Trucking Associations. And with me today is Jennifer Bowe from CNF Transportation and Jeff Skotulis from USF Right-Away. We're here today to talk about the weight mile tax. Actually, just kidding. I thought you might enjoy that.
Remember, I've got the gap.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to say that I find it very unfair that Bob is toying with Dick Yates' feelings. And somewhere in the revenue office, Dick got a big grin all of a sudden, and now he's shattered.
Actually, we're here to talk about the business activity tax. We were reluctant to appear before this committee until we actually had an opportunity for our members to thoroughly analyze the impact and determine what the difference would be under the current income tax system and the proposed business activity tax. We have now been able to complete that analysis, at least a number of our companies have, and the results were startling to say the least. What I'd like to do today is I'd like to sort of generally talk to you about the impacts on the trucking industry, and then Jennifer and Jeff are going to talk to you about the specific aspect or impacts on their company. Today, approximately 80% of Oregon-based trucking companies operate in Oregon and other states. This is a significant change. Prior to 1995, most Oregon-based trucking companies confined their operations within the state. But in 95, we were deregulated, which many of you will remember. Competition has dramatically increased, and as a result, we've spread out geographically in terms of our operations. So what this has done, and for comparison purposes, when you think about the impact of the business activity tax, it's best to compare us to a manufacturer where they're exporting most of their product to other states for sale. We have the same export kind of an issue in the trucking industry. So far, you've had most of your discussions regarding C-Corps, and that's understandable because you've got the best relevant information about C-Corps. However, when we look at the trucking industry, very few companies are, in fact, C-Corps. Most of them are subchapter S's, LLCs, partnerships, or sole proprietorships. These particular companies do not pay corporate income tax today. So the business activity tax is going to look like a brand new tax to them. And certainly you have attempted to compensate by reducing the personal income tax rates, but I would guarantee you in the minds of most business owners, they're not going to make that connection. Whereas with the C-Corps, what you've done is you've actually eliminated the corporate income tax and replaced it with a back tax. And I think people will be able to see that. But for the majority of trucking companies, they are clearly going to view this as a brand new tax. There are a couple of different ways that the trucking industry obtains labor, and it depends on the segment of the industry. It's very common in our industry to use what we call owner-operators or contract employees. Other segments of the industry rely heavily on drivers or regular employees, for example, the LTL segment. What the business activity tax encourages is for us to go from employees to owner-operators because we're being taxed on payroll, benefits, and those kinds of expenditures. If we shift to owner-operators, we will be able to reduce our tax significantly. And I think this is an issue that is fairly unique to trucking, but it is a significant issue when you look at calculating the base. Trucking is also a very mobile industry, particularly when you think about the administrative employees. If a trucking company is operating in multiple states or operating nationwide and you've got central administration, quite frankly, it really doesn't matter what state that central administration is located in. And I suspect that with the advent of the business activity tax, a number of companies that have their main administrative offices in Oregon are going to look elsewhere because, again, they're being taxed on their Oregon payroll and the benefits that they provide. There are several large buildings in downtown Portland that are occupied by trucking company administrative offices, and I don't think that's the kind of thing that we really want to encourage. Partially as a result of deregulation in 95, and because of a number of other factors, the profits in the trucking industry have shrunk to an all-time low. Part of it's the increased competition. Part of it's the exorbitant weight mile tax rates, and I apologize, I couldn't resist that one. Skyrocketing fuel prices and a chronic driver shortage. And when you look at the trucking industry today, it's probably fair to characterize us as sort of being one of those industries that's on the ropes. Our concern is that we are one of the basic industries that sort of fuels the entire economic engine. If you can't get your product to market, then you can't sell it. That's why we used to be a regulated industry, because we were considered to be a public utility. My concern is with the already deteriorated condition of our industry, if we get hit with something as significant as this, it could very well destabilize the Oregon-based trucking industry. If that were to happen, the ripple effects through our entire economy, I think, would be astronomical. Unfortunately, the economic models like OTIM and others that we use aren't really capable of detecting that kind of economic impact. But it's certainly something that I would encourage you to take a look at and be cognizant of. Finally, as a person that has designed a new tax for Oregon, albeit for a single industry, I would strongly suggest that you proceed with a great deal of care and caution. Economic models are wonderful, but there's nothing that replaces testing your hypothesis in the real world, and that means getting it out there and having lots of folks calculate how it would impact their business. Unfortunately, that takes a lot of time. And at least from my perspective, I would recommend that the committee consider having some sort of interim effort where we could study this issue and come back to the 2003 session and see if there's not a way that we can't figure out how to make it work. That concludes my prepared testimony, and now I'd like to turn it over to Jennifer.
Chairman Shetterly and members of the commission, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, I'm Jennifer Bowe. I'm a state tax supervisor for CNF Transportation up in Portland. I'm here as an employee of a company involved in the trucking industry. Just as, or even more important to this discussion,
We are a company with a high level of Oregon capital investment and a large number of family wage Oregon jobs. In light of Tuesday's testimony on the allocation of sports action lottery funds, I will vote proud Portland State University grad. CNF owns over $100 million in Oregon property, including a $35 million brand new office building in Northwest Portland and 190,000 square feet of Portland office space we expect to purchase next month. In 2000, we employed almost 1,600 Oregonians, and we paid over $90 million in Oregon wages and taxable benefits and $8 million in Oregon taxes and fees. Taxes are ultimately paid from net income. Net income, therefore, may be seen as the measure of an entity's ability to pay tax. That is one reason why net income is used as a tax base in nearly all states that impose a corporate-level tax. Those few states that use another measure, such as compensation, gross receipts, or capital value, have been forced to enact loopholes, exemptions, and credits to mitigate the adverse effect of these taxes, further complicating their tax structures. Three of the states that were most reliant on these types of taxes have either phased them out or repealed them outright. House Bill 3942 replaces a relatively simple tax, the corporate net income tax, with a tax that is unnecessarily complex and very difficult to comply with. As I mentioned before, the state with a similar tax base enacted many exemptions, modifications, loopholes, and exceptions before finally concluding that, quote, the only way to reform the tax is to repeal the tax. That state is now phasing out the tax. Besides adding to the compliance burden, the proposed business activity tax would punish our company and companies like ours that have invested in Oregon and that provide stable employment, family wages, and excellent benefits. By disallowing a deduction for compensation and by defining compensation so broadly, the bill would effectively tax us based on the payroll and benefits we provide. Under this bill, our 1999 Oregon income taxes would have increased from approximately $300,000 to $1.5 million. Or 500%. Further, two companies with the same net income and therefore the same ability to pay a tax could easily have different tax liabilities under this bill. Under the proposed tax, the company that provides benefits to its employees will pay more tax than a company that does not. In short, this bill taxes a company based on its compensation and benefits. This increases the cost of employing Oregonians, paying them well, and providing benefits, all activities we often see as desirable behaviors. I'm not an expert in tax theory. I'm not an expert in economics. But it seems fair to say that good tax policy, at the very least, should not punish the good corporate citizens. The proposed law hurts Oregon businesses, Oregon employees, and Oregon families, and inevitably the long-term welfare of our state. I would urge a no vote on House Bill 3942. Thank you.
Questions, all you bad people.
I
Representative Bates.
I assume Batman's not going to fly in this.
Batman is staying hidden.
Yeah. Just a couple of quick questions,
yeah, sure.
If I could. You know, the base of this tax is that we're so dependent on the individual income tax and corporate tax state, leaving us in a precarious position in times of economic decline. Do you offer an alternative to that scenario of something that could be fixed?
Chairman Shetterly and Representative Bates, if I had a solution, I probably would not be working where I am. I'd be somewhere else.
Well, Bob, didn't you do a paper in college?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, from at least from my perspective and based on my experience as a former tax collector, I don't reject the value-added tax out of hand. I think our testimony is specifically directed towards this particular bill and the way this tax has been designed at this point. And I recognize that it's likely that there will be numbers of changes. What I'm suggesting, and I think the way I concluded my testimony, was that we take an adequate amount of time to do that analysis if we want to proceed forward. And the trucking industry is committed to working with you towards that end.
Hold that thought.
Yeah, Batman may still fly.
Yeah. Representative, was that Beck or Hass? Okay.
Well, you said that one of the problems, though, is that some of these S corporations and some of these businesses pay no tax under this scenario. So, what could we do
what alterations or modifications could we make, lowering the rate or changing it, that would ever bring those people on board?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, in some of the discussions that I've had with Mr. Warner, we've talked about some ways to address that. Certainly, as part of the bill, you're already reducing the personal income tax rate, and that's where these people pay their tax. But there's also the potential, and I don't believe it's on the list yet, for a pass-through credit based on the business activity tax that you pay in terms of your business, where you actually are taxed in terms of income is on the personal side. You could pass through a credit from the business activity tax to the personal income tax and offset the results. Now, one of the issues that is on your list is taxpayer education. And when we're doing this kind of thing, that becomes a critical issue. Because as it is now, and the perception would certainly be that it's a new tax and something they never paid before, and I guarantee you most of them aren't going to understand that their personal income tax has been reduced as well, because their next-door neighbor may very well be an employee of a company, and they also get the reduction in personal impact. But if you do a pass-through of the business activity tax, in some way give a credit on the personal income tax for people that have S corporations, LLCs, sole proprietorships, and the like, then I think you begin to address that. Is that?
Yes, thank you. Encouraged by your remarks that you would like to quote, take some more time to see if we can make it work.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, I think the trucking industry is very sensitive to the plight of the state of Oregon being totally reliant on a single tax, and the impacts of Measure 5 transferring the responsibility to school funding to the state, and looking at a way to provide a more diverse and stable tax base. We think that goal is a worthy one, and we're willing to work towards that end.
President Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. I think that you'll find that the scenario that you described there regarding the trucking business is true not only of trucking industry, but all small business throughout Oregon. You know, that the same type of scenario fits right there. And there is a trend in Oregon, and I assume probably nationwide, for small businesses to move away from the C-Corp to S-Corps into LLCs.
Absolutely.
And they do that for one reason, is to pay one tax as opposed to two.
Do you have some testimony?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Jeff Scotchless. I'm the Vice President and Chief Financial Officer for USF Right-Away. It's an Oregon-based trucking company, LTL Trucking Corporation, that operates in 9 western states, very similar to the scenario that Mr. Russell painted earlier. We have 56 terminal locations in these 9 western states, 14 of those terminals being in Oregon, and including our corporate offices located in just outside of Portland. So we are in the scenario that Mr. Russell did explain, and we've had the opportunity. I am not a tax expert. I am a chief financial officer, which I'm looking at from a business management standpoint and the effects that this possible bill will have on our company. We've had the opportunity to mirror this new proposal up against our 1999 tax payments. And for 1999, the existing tax structure is based on an apportionment formula, which we were 31% apportioned in Oregon. That produced for USF Right-Away a tax bill of $528,000 that year. Under the new proposal, that tax bill jumps to $1.2 million, very similar to the results of the other companies that we're hearing from. And one of the things I look at there in the proposal is what we don't get deductions for, or we have to add back to our income base, is, as spoke of earlier, salaries, insurance benefits, pension benefits, profit sharing, depreciation, interest paid. Now, in a trucking company, in less than truckload trucking company, that we look at, those items there constitute about 70% of our total costs. The trucking industry is a very low margin business. If you're profitable after tax anywhere from 2 to 5%. You're doing a wonderful job. These costs, as I mentioned, as the add-backs, the new tax structure, represent 70% add-back into our tax base. So that's what creates our tax bill going up from $500,000 to $1.2 million. And being a business manager and process manager, as Mr. Russell indicated, it would encourage me as the manager of our company to do the exact same things that Mr. Russell was speaking of earlier, move from the employee-based benefit structure to an owner-operator structure. Our corporate office, we employ several hundred people in our corporate office. I would move to more and more temporary labor, which I don't think is good for the employees, but from the corporate standpoint, that's what's encouraged by this tax bill, to get away from the benefits being paid and the salary and wages and move into an owner-operator. And also from the standpoint that we are 9 Western states, our corporate office can be in any state. So therefore, from that same token, we can move our corporate office to another state that might be much more favorable tax-wise to us, as opposed to paying Oregon wages. Not something we'd like to do, but we feel this is punitive enough to the trucking industry businesses that it does really change the financial aspects. This is a tough time in the trucking industry with the slow economy, the rising fuel prices, driver wages due to the driver shortages. There are a lot of companies that maintain very minimal profitability. And if you move away from a tax base that's based on profitability and move to a business activity tax, I think that may throw a lot of these companies, whether they're S-corporations or C-corps, that would turn these companies to a non-profit basis and they wouldn't be even a viable operation and therefore losing jobs in the Oregon market. So from the business process, I don't feel there's a lot of positive points in the current structure of something that could be worked out. Thank you for the opportunity to address you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, United Parcel Service also did the analysis and they weren't able to be here today to testify, but they did want me to give you the results. Under the business activity tax, their tax would increase by 300%, and that represents a $2.4 million a year increase to UPS. And although UPS is a very large corporation, they said that it would definitely have an impact on their Oregon operations.
Thank you. Anybody?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this is really for Paul, I think. Paul, is it correct that contracted labor would not be value-added, but salaries would be value-added?
That's correct. Any purchases you make from another business would not be part of your base. However, the contractor would be subject to the VAT at their level. There wouldn't be avoidance of the tax. There would be a change in the initial incidence. But remember, one of the things we talked about is how we may see some reduction in gross wages. I think that's one of the ways that the economy would work through a reduction in gross wages would be if there was either a threat to go to contract labor or the actual going to contract labor would have that effect. Yeah. But it would change who pays the VAT.
Yeah, on the surface. I mean, presumably the contractor would become part of the cost of doing business and get passed on to the company.
Right. And I think what we're hearing in the testimony is that a portion of that tax anyway would fall on labor. And that's basically what our model is telling us.
Thank you very much for coming. Sorry, go ahead.
If I have a question, Bob, we had talked earlier, and this came up in terms of the testimony. Could you talk about the apportionment and how that might affect the BAT from the industry standpoint? If apportionment were changed in a way similar to House Bill 2281, which just came out of this committee?
Paul, I would defer that to the experts here. The portion of this might be
here. I don't know if you're tracking our committee or not, but House Bill 2281 would go to a single sales factor, and wondering if you thought about how that might affect the BAT if you're using a sales apportionment factor.
From our standpoint at USF Rudderway, in the current factor, as I said, we were 31%. If we go to a single sales factor, that would drop to 24%. That's a real world for us on the single factor of revenue only.
Mm-hmm. I would add that the change in the apportionment factor would benefit the same companies and hurt the same companies under a BAT structure as under the current net income structure.
Okay.
Yeah. So that impact would not be specific to the BAT.
Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think the question, though, is the single sales factor which passed out of this committee a few days ago, I guess. How does that affect your company, the fact that it's going to be a tax, the apportionment of the tax would be strictly on sales instead of also being on payroll and capital investment? I would think it would help your company if your operations in Oregon are extensive, and I think and they are, right?
It would, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Sorry you had to wait a couple days to testify. We are going to close the hearing on House Bill 3942 and open.
Got a work session.
Oh, okay.
If
open a work session on 2704.
If you wanted to wait, Madam Chair, okay. The chair had asked me to say a little something about the forecast.
Oh, okay.
Maybe this would be a good time to do that.
Take a pause, then we won't.
Until he comes back. Okay. I had talked to the co-chairs and the revenue chairs yesterday. We have gotten the March income tax data from the Department of Revenue, and that's always the first step in the revenue forecast process, which I remember well. And so you can compare that quarter with what was forecast for the January, February, March period. And what it shows is, if you look at the March forecast, that the latest forecast, withholding receipts were $7 million higher than forecast. What we call other payments, which is estimated final payments, were $19 million more. Refunds were $25 million less, for a net of $51 million more than forecast in the first quarter. The refund piece is particularly tricky because the timing of it varies so much. A lot of it depends on when the department is processing and when those returns are coming in. So I tend to put less faith in those numbers is what they're telling us. But I think the important thing is there was $26 million more in actual payments than forecast during the first quarter. So in all likelihood, that means that at least for this biennium, you're going to see a higher number forecast, but of course it also means a bigger predicted kicker for to be paid out next biennium.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Well, we've got a kicker in there now on the personal side, and this would make it bigger.
Reprimand what?
Through the Madam Chair here.
Cutting in line.
Why don't you reprimand him? But Paul, so that means the kicker estimate now might be as high as what, 360 or 370 million, the personal kicker.
Yes, the previous estimate was 337. So if you just added that, I would say add that 26 to it, that would give you a sense. The second quarter withholding forecast is pretty low too. It's about growth a little over 1% on a year-over-year basis, which would be very weak growth. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I think is worth mentioning is that the corporate revenue the first quarter tends to be small because it's a it's a time when there's not any actual payments due, but it was $55 million in collections. The forecast was 33, so that's a plus 22 on the corporate side. And as you recall, in the last forecast, there was not a corporate kicker being forecast, so I think you can anticipate that coming back into the forecast when it comes out on the 14th of May.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So you're anticipating there may very well be a corporate kicker now?
Yes, correct.
And how big? What's the threshold point there?
I believe the threshold is, we're just below it now. I think we're at $17 million over. If you add the 22, we'd be up around 40.
Okay. Representative Beck.
Does this reflect capital gain income, these figures, I assume that reflects taxes paid off capital gains as well?
Representative Beck, I think there may be some of that, but I remember that, you know, if you owe taxes, like I owed, I didn't owe state tax, but I owed federal taxes, mm-hmm. So I mailed my return in Sunday night, and I think most people who owe taxes probably did the same thing. So these data are through March, so that's where you really pick up that effect will be on those April payments.
I've heard someone express to me last winter even that that because of a lot of selling off stock, people there's going to be quite a substantial and a maybe unanticipated capital gain revenue. I don't know how that comes to state, but they've said a lot of those people haven't filed until last 2 weeks, and we don't have that. We
don't have that. The one thing we do know that we see from the returns coming in is that they're running under last year. And what that means is people are holding off filing, and that usually means they owe money.
Yeah.
And that would be one potential explanation, is that while their portfolios may be down in value,
right,
they've made adjustments, and when they made those adjustments, they had a taxable event,
right,
namely a capital gain,
right,
from when they bought the stock, and then they would owe some money on that. Of course, the thing to keep in mind about these numbers are they're not necessarily going to translate into more resources for you,
right,
in terms of the budget because of the kicker effects. And to the extent that they do reflect this selling off at losses, you know, that doesn't bode well for next year in terms of capital gains revenue. So I don't see these numbers as meaning you've got more resources necessarily. It just probably means you're going to be looking at a corporate kicker and a larger personal kicker.
Just more opportunities.
More opportunities.
Okay. Did we finish with 3942 then? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. Just wanted to make sure. I apologize for stepping out. I was making the world safe from environmental sabotage up in the Senate Judiciary Committee. That done, we're back to work.
You sound like Batman.
Yeah. Where's Representative Whip? I want to go to his bill next.
Did you want
something wrong? Well, did you close the work session? I'm not sure what you said. So,
I'm sorry, I did. I thought you said to close it up.
Did you say anything about the interim work? Well, you didn't.
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I didn't.
Okay. Well, let me, just so we're on the record then, in House Bill 3942, I'll just reopen the work session briefly to make a public comment. I think I've spoken with all the members individually. Clearly, with the list of issues that Paul's identified and the thoughtful testimony we've received, including that which we've heard today, my inclination is to, rather than force this issue before its time is ready, to move this to a very focused and active interim, not study, but work group. I don't think we need another study. We've got plenty of studies on our shelves. And so I've asked Paul to amend House Bill 3942 to make it a bill creating a work group, giving it a charge to develop legislative proposals or approaches to an amended tax and revenue system that would include, among other things, reduction in reliance on the personal income tax, a more stable rate of revenue growth, a system that will create or at least sustain a healthy economic business climate in the state. Probably want to look at some low-income pieces on that as well. All the good things, and then it really becomes a matter of filling in the details with working with people like Mr. Russell, who we heard today, and others who have different perspectives on this during the interim. And speaking with the co-chairs about this, my intention is to include in the bill a authorization for the task force to receive grants and donations to help fund its efforts, and Representative Westland offered to suggested that we put a blank appropriation in there, and he would try to put in some seed money to get the work group off the ground and started. So I want to make this even more intensive than just a interim work plan for the General Revenue Committee, although my plan would be to involve Revenue Committee members on this, but then also broaden the work group to include members of the public, business community, and other taxpayer organizations, and then perhaps even do some field hearings on this thing to bring it around the state and invite testimony from individuals statewide. But do a very good effort to come back next session with a well-analyzed and very thoughtful way to move forward. So, satisfied with that, we'll get some amendments next week, and I just wanted to get the gauge the Batman's. Oh, he thinks it's a good idea.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so that will close the work session of 3942. Representative Witt, we are back with you. Open a work session on House Bill 2704.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've looked at the Dash 1 amendments and the Dash 2 amendments here, and Dash 1 amendments look very consistent with what we talked about last time. So, Chairman, like, I'd be happy to move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2704.
Okay. Representative Witt moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2704. Ed, do you want to speak to those? And what about the Dash 2 amendments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dash 1 amendments set the base standard deduction amounts at the levels we agreed on last time. That is, the standard deduction amount in 2002 tax year for joint filers would be set at $3,280, and the standard deduction amount for single filers would be set at $1,640.
Okay. And the Dash 2 amendment? I'm sorry, I guess we're only on the Dash 1. You just moved the Dash 1 amendment. Is there any discussion on the Dash 1 amendment? Any objection?
Mr. Chairman, you should tell Ways and Means we just found some money for it.
We did. That might fund our study group. Just about. Okay, the Dash 1 amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I would also move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2704.
Representative Witt moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2704. And Ed, please tell us about those.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendments index was base standard deduction amounts for inflation beginning 2003 tax year.
Questions about the Dash 2? I assume that technically that's all standard indexing language.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It's pretty much boilerplate.
Okay. Deborah, have you seen the Dash 2s? You're looking at them right now. Do you want to take just a second to look at them? Are you... You're fine. Deborah is fine. Glad to hear it. All right, Representative Witt has moved the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2704. Is there any discussion on those? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I move House Bill 2704 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Witt moves House Bill 2704 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Solving our marriage penalty problem here in the state of Oregon. Any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
For Representative Kefouri.
Big surprise. I'm going to be opposing this measure. Well, I do think that I appreciate the attempt to solve the marriage penalty program. I don't think we should do so on the backs of those who are single. And while I realize that it doesn't increase taxes for single people by a great margin, I do believe that we should not be increasing taxes on one group of people to lower the taxes for another group of people. So I'm going to be voting no. Although I'm not single, I'm married, I probably will benefit from this. I'm looking out for all my single friends out there, including the representative from North West Point.
Okay, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I certainly appreciate Representative Kefouri's concern here. I mean, I don't necessarily enjoy raising taxes on anybody, and I would have preferred, if we could have responsibly have done it, to simply to have increased the standard deduction for married taxpayers from $3,000 to $3,600. But the sense, I think, here and generally in the body was that we weren't going to, at this point in time, suffer that kind of revenue decline. So I thought the next best thing to do was to at least eliminate the marriage penalty and adjust the tax rates correspondingly. And I believe that the current tax system is unfair to people that are married. And I use the example, if you have two people living together who are single, they get a $3,600 standard deduction. Once they get married, they get a $3,000 standard deduction. So that's an inherent unfairness, it seems to me. And what we have done here in a revenue-neutral way is we have corrected that unfairness. Yes, the taxes do go up slightly on people filing a single return, but we've removed this unfairness in the tax code. We're not penalizing people when they get married, and I think that's it's appropriate that we don't penalize people as they get married.
Representative Williams.
Mr. Chair, I'd just say that I think Representative Beck has had it too good for too long, so we're gonna get our money back from him, and he's going to figure out that it's better off for him to get married and be a responsible citizen.
Well, and Ed, we are raising the, for single individuals, we're raising the standard deduction
the Respect Marriage Incentive Act
from $1,500 to $1,640. I'm sorry, we're reducing it rather from $1,800 to $1,640.
Mm-hmm.
That's a difference of $160. And if we've got a 9% taxpayer, that's about $15 in the year.
That's right, per taxpayer.
Okay.
For what? Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Corey.
I agree. I'm saying it's not a large sum of money, but I don't see what benefit that single taxpayer is getting. They're paying $15 more in taxes, not because they're trying to help the homeless or because they're trying to feed the hungry, but because somebody who's married is paying more in taxes. So, anyway, we don't have to argue this discussion. We'll see it on the floor.
Okay, Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gafori could certainly bring a minority report with somebody else raising it to $3,600 and leaving it at $1,800, and I wouldn't necessarily object to that.
Thank you for your suggestion.
Minority report.
Okay, please call the roll.
Yeah, quickly.
Representative Faye.
Excused.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
I'm sorry, that doesn't count.
I think if I should give my friend company. I'm going to vote. I'll vote aye today.
We're not going to bring this up again tomorrow.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
Yeah.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Tafari.
Nay.
Vote aye. House Bill 2704 as amended goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Witt?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Now, let me go to work session, close the work session then on 2704. And let's have some discussion about HJM 25. Open a work session on House Joint Memorial 25. And my thinking of bringing these up today is that House Joint Memorial 25 is the memorial to Congress to rectify the marriage penalty under federal law. I think I was the one who suggested that if we were going to bring both of these up, it would be convenient and fitting, I think, to bring these up on the same day on the floor. Now, I want to get back to where we left. I think Representative Hass was expressing some reservation about another memorial altogether, and so I'll bring it up for committee discussion. If somebody wants to move it, we'll move it out. It's up to you. Representative Hass.
My only reservation was on the issue of memorial.
Yeah, I understand.
Not on this particular issue.
Yeah, I understand.
We have.
Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Joint Memorial 25 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Witt moves House Joint Memorial 25 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Corey.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we save the money that we would spend by passing this memorial and send it to the single people of the state of Oregon. We're going to raise their taxes on the last.
Can you do a minority report on a memorial? Yeah, I guess you can.
She's been there. She's been there, done that.
Representative Williams.
You know, Mr. Chair, I understand and express even some similar concerns of Representative Hass about the degree to which we memorialize around here to Congress. And the reason I comment on this is since our last discussion, I had the unique occasion to have a fairly small dinner with former Senator Hatfield. In the course of that conversation, I posed the question to him, what do you do with the memorials, or what did you do with all the memorials that we sent you? And he said in his entire time in Congress, he did not recall a single time having a memorial from the Oregon legislature actually cross his desk. Whether it was intercepted by staff or whether it's wallpapering a particular room somewhere in the Capitol where they put all these up, I don't know. But I do wonder if it is sort of an exercise in futility on our part. Interestingly, he also told me, Senator Hatfield also mentioned, that when he was in the legislature, he had actually moved for and had a bill which would have actually abolished the sending of memorials to Congress, which I thought was sort of interesting at the same time. I will vote in support of Representative Witt's motion because I think it is the practice of what we're doing here, and because I support fundamentally Congress's attempt to do what we've just done with this bill. But I do think that we've gone a bit memorial crazy in this building over the last few years, and I do question their worth.
Anybody else? Representative Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I appreciate what Representative Williams has just said because I have seen the same is true, but I think as with anything else, I mean, people develop bills in here, but unless they have a conversation with the person that they want to pass the bill, usually it doesn't go anywhere. I think it behooves us as legislators, if we want to memorialize something, to set up the communication network so we're not just mailing a letter to Washington, D.C., that we actually have opportunities to have discussions about these issues. And I think the more we have, the better off we're going to do, because federal issues obviously impact the state of Oregon.
Chair, Representative Beck.
Well, I would throw in another salvo, I guess. Not that's the wrong word, but plea to resist doing this. We're passing a substantive piece of policy out that sends the message. They're more likely to pay attention to that. One more memorial beyond all the memorials that the Government Efficiency is doing. It just seems unnecessary. I would encourage the committee to not do this. We're passing a bill out. It's just going to create another discussion on the floor. It's going to waste another 30 minutes that we could all be doing bigger and better things. And I just encourage us to not do this. Maybe withdraw the motion or. But we're solving the issue, and locally, and I think that sends a strong message. I would encourage us all to just vote no.
Well, I tell you, if we were passing this out, if this was all by itself, I don't think I would be inclined to take the time of another memorial as well, although I don't think that it'll take 30 minutes on the floor to do this, especially when we pair this with 2704. I just think there's a nice symmetry to passing 2704, which establishes state law, and then while we have this in our possession and right in front of us while we're at it, sending a message to Congress that basically says, we've done it, why don't you? To me, they just fit well together. Representative Brown?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the comments that I've heard regarding the memorial could be extended to a number of the other bills that I've heard in my limited time here.
Can you put a memorial on the calendar?
Mr. Chairman, I certainly hope that Representative Brown is not talking about any of Representative Beck's bills. I would be highly insulted for him if that was the case.
And Representative Beck can be assured I wasn't talking about that.
Okay, we have a motion before us, and that is to send House Joint Memorial 25 before the due pass recommendation. Sorry, sir, we're in work session, not in public hearing.
That's the first time I've ever done this.
Okay, that's all right. We had a... Please call the roll.
Okay, Representative Fay.
Excused.
Staff.
Aye.
Aye.
Staff.
Is that a loophole?
Aye.
Oh,
aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Safari.
Aye.
Chair Shatterly.
Aye. House Joint Memorial 25 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We need a carrier, probably somebody other than Representative Witt. What?
Yes, Representative Starr's memorial.
Bipartisan.
What's it? Oh, well. No. We got it?
No, I'm just...
Go ahead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anybody else on the committee want it? Otherwise, I'll be glad to ask him. Okay, Representative Starr will carry it.
I can
ask him. Okay. that takes care of House Joint Memorial 25. And committee, that ends our business today. Let me say that tomorrow we have, oh, what is it? It's the Quest, yeah, Big Bill, Big Interim Report. Please try to be here as prompt as possible. Next week we have an absolutely chock-full schedule of all the bills that I finally got requests on in the last few days to hear. So we got a busy week next week, and it's going to just get busier as we get to the end of the session. So, with that, we're adjourned.
That's it? There's nothing else going on in the courthouse.